Hello and welcome to session two. Today's seminar is called What Every Bass Player Wishes the Worship Leader Knew, or What Every Worship Leader Wishes the Bass Player Knew. I like to call it Marty Finally Gets the Chance to Speak His Mind. Just kidding. My name is Martin Stamm, and I'll be discussing and demonstrating some of the things that I think will help propel our corporate worship in regards to the bass guitar and utilizing this instrument in the ensemble. I think worship leaders often underestimate the value of the bass guitar in propelling corporate worship. We want the ensemble to be rich and full, but we definitely don't want the bass to be distracting. My main points are people skills, theoretical and musical understanding, technological or technical understanding, ensemble issues, and finally, lessons that I've learned the hard way. Let's begin with people skills. I think that worship leaders often have to have this beautiful balance between musicianship and direction and being a good communicator and uniquely gifted in finding common ground among musicians and also people in the congregation as well. I think the problem with most bass players is that most bass players are really bad and they play horrible music and they play horrible notes on their bass. So people tell them to turn down. Often the bass player is the guy who is a bad guitar player and they won't let him play guitar. So they say, okay, Jimmy, you play bass. And he doesn't know exactly what he's doing. So everybody tells him to turn down and play different. He develops an inferiority complex. This is why the bass player is often frowning. If you notice lots of pictures of the bass player, they're usually frowning or looking sort of foreboding. I don't know. Instead of telling them what not to do, I would encourage worship leaders to encourage the bass player by explaining that they are the bus driver. They are hugely important. If you think about the ensemble as a bus, a lot of times there's an analogy of the bass player being the bus driver. They keep the groove going, jumping right down the road. Directing someone to play simple and confidently, especially making clear the form and transitions in the song, can actually instill a lot of confidence because they say, sure, I can do that. Likewise, nothing makes bass players, or anyone else for that matter, feel worse than when the worship leader makes a reference to a band or artist that they haven't heard of, or haven't heard. Even well-intentioned, this can make people feel like dummies, which is totally not God-honoring. I know in my own experience, there's kind of like, sometimes there can be like this culture of like, what is the cool band and what is the uncool band? And so when people kind of like try to make a reference to something that's like the new like darling of whatever is cool, the people that haven't checked that out yet, they feel like they're out of the loop. And it just makes people feel bad. So there's a huge resource in referencing songs, be it from some kind of sacred reference or from popular culture, or, you know, something that your little kid played on the xylophone, you know, we can use those, especially with today's technology, to create cool references for our music and make everybody in the band do something that is amazing and can propel the corporate worship and energize people's participation more than just playing the same old tune the way they did 5 Sundays ago or whenever it was the last time they played that tune. But you got to do it in the right way so it's not ostracizing people and that everybody has access to checking it out. A lot of the ways that I think worship leaders have done a good job of doing this is, you know, put it up on the internet when you send out the email of the tunes to the musicians, or have it on your phone and play for everybody at the beginning of the rehearsal so they all can hear it, regardless of whether they're familiar with that band or that groove or that style of music, you know? Be very careful about making fun of a certain musical style or talking in a derogatory way about a group or band. This might be a huge influence of one of your musicians. You never know. It's not God-honoring or uplifting. I feel like mean-spirited humor, especially being a bass player who is often the butt of every joke, is sometimes a real stumbling block in churches and in contemporary worship culture specifically. People's feelings are so easily hurt. On the other hand, laughing at ourselves can be a real bonding experience. Instead of assuming everyone knows what we're talking about, I think it's a great idea to periodically indoctrinate new musicians, especially bass players and drummers, with your biggest musical influences. Then they will understand what you mean when you direct them to go dun, 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 or something like that, you know. In my own experience, playing in different churches and being in different church cultures and working with different pastors and worship leaders, if you don't know them real well, you don't know what their biggest musical influences are and what kind of makes them tick musically. One example is, there was a worship leader in the church that I worked with, and he always kind of had this certain thing that he was going for. I couldn't really catch on to it. And then I found out that his background is in musical theater, and he's into this bombastic, over-the-top type stuff, and this certain singing style that's real prevalent in musical theater. And everybody said, oh, now we know, you know. And it even goes so far as, like, their song selections and, like, the way they play, the way they select their kind of chord progressions and stuff like that. And the same thing goes for the church that I'm in now. I was confused by what was happening in the bands. No matter, you know, there's a lot of people involved in the worship ministry, and I would be standing there on stage saying, why is it that this certain sound is coming, especially from the guitar players? I don't know what they're trying to do, and often it's confusing me, and I feel like it sounds almost like bad or wrong, you know? Those are very strong words, but finally, after a long time, I asked one of these guys, and this particular pastor, he listed for me 3 CDs that were the biggest influences for him. When I listened to them, then I understood. It's just a stylistic thing, and it is a certain sound that they're going for. This one in particular, it used kind of a reverb and delay in the guitars, and a certain playing style with the guitar. Um, and the drums too, for that matter. But I once I heard those tunes as a reference, then I understood what they were going for. It was so much easier for me to understand, rather than the worship leader feeling like he's beating his head against the wall trying to explain the same thing to me again and again. Okay, to conclude this people skills section, frequent info or info sessions or crash courses in notation and stylistic language. This won't intimidate or offend those with different musical backgrounds. It's just a way to get everybody on the same page. Especially if you're in a band or if you're in a church where they don't use a lot of like written out music, it's a lot of chord charts or a certain type of notation that they use. That can freak people out. That could be an amazing, amazing resource to the ministry, because they just don't know the lingo or the jargon or the slang words that you're talking about. And instead of having a worship ministry picnic in the summer and a worship ministry, you know, Christmas party in the winter, and that's the only time everybody gets together, I wish that some worship leaders would have like a periodic, like maybe, I don't know, on a Wednesday night or something like that, just a crash course in the way they do things, the way they, their lingo. They can use an example of a chord chart and just say, this is what this means. When it's a big letter, or when there's an M after it, you know, that means minor. Or when I make notes on my chart, I do little slashes for the number of beats. Or, you know, if there's an arrow pointing forward, that means I speed up. Or, you know, an X. All these different things. A lot of musicians have sort of different ways of marking their music, but there is a sort of generalized, accepted way of doing this. And I think that if worship pastors would indoctrinate, so to speak, the people in their worship ministry, then there'd be a lot of miscommunication that wouldn't happen. there'd be less miscommunication, and there'd definitely be less train wrecks in the music, especially regarding the form, meter, key, rhythmic hits, and so forth and so on. An example of this might be like, come to our info session, how to write out a rhythmic figure or how to make a little chart. And this part can be in bold or underlined. You don't need to be able to read music to do this. There's killer musicians who don't read music. And likewise, there's musicians that read music who are horrible. Let's get into our next point, which is the theoretical or musical understanding of things. As a bass player, I wish that the worship leaders and especially the songwriters would pay more attention to the root movement of their chord progressions when they're doing songwriting and especially hymn rewriting. Many bass players have a chip on their shoulder because they have a better understanding of the chord progressions and harmonies than their role affords them the opportunity to employ. the best way I think that worship leaders can work on this is to forget the chords. When you're writing a progression or working on some substitute chord changes over a praise and worship song or even a hymn, try the melody and the bass line together. If the bass line and the melody are clashing with each other, and by the bass line I mean the root movement of the chord progression, if that is clashing, then there's no chord in the world that's going to make it sound happy, especially to the bass player, who's going to then start frowning. If you are making something on the piano or the guitar and it sounds kind of cool, before you publish it, try just playing the bass line and singing the melody at the same time. If it clashes, for instance, a chord movement of a tritone in the bass, or parallel fourths or parallel fifths between the bass movement and the melody, or awkward jumping in and out of a unison, sometimes can be kind of a red flag to change something there. Next, a theoretical or a musical thing that I wish the bass players wish the worship leaders would kind of employ or spend a little bit more time on is the clarity of the count off and meter. Sometimes there's not a real clear count off, and sometimes no one even knows what the meter of the song is, whether it's 4-4, 3-4, or 6-8. And it's totally needless. And that's one part of preparation that is it's super important. And when people neglect it, it really, really shows. It really, really shows. A lot of chord charts that we have for our songs don't include the meter. I have no idea why. Please remember to account for pickup notes in the instruments or vocals. This really helps the bass player, because if they can get into a song where they are, if the bass player knows where to start playing and he can have a real smooth entrance, forget it. That gives a bass player so much confidence. It makes them so happy they'll start smiling. I wish we spent more time in rehearsal instead of you know, making it, going through the song all the way through. I wish that sometimes in the rehearsals of the tunes we would just spend an extra minute or an extra few minutes just practicing getting into and out of each tune. Like I said before, if my entrance is clean, then I feel really good, and it just is a really strong thing. And that'll reflect to the congregation too. If you go 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Dun in, you know, everybody's in right on the downbeat, nice and strong. It doesn't have to be loud, but if it's strong, it's like electrocuting everybody. They know that is, yes, this is the time. Okay. One note about orchestration in our theoretical musical section is when to play and when not to play is as important as what you play. And worship leaders and bass players alike are often reluctant to lay out or tell another person to lay out. You know, we think to ourselves, I have to play the entire song because I'm the bass player. Or I have to play the entire song because I'm the drummer. or I have to play the entire song because I'm the worship leader and I have an acoustic guitar, or, you know, I'm the lead singer who also plays piano, so, you know, I have to keep on playing throughout the whole song. No, you don't. Just because you have 10 people in your band does not mean that 10 people have to be playing the entire time. And this, forget the notes or the arrangement or the chords, just the fact of having some people play at other points and then everybody play at other points is a huge tool in itself in terms of the trajectory of these songs and making the worship be full at some places and, you know, maybe contemplative at other places. It really, 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 really affects the mood and the feel of the music. I mean, look at a symphony orchestra, like a Mahler symphony or something like that. Is the percussion playing the entire time while the wind section is playing and the string sections are all playing at the same time? No. That's what orchestration is. Some guys are kind of featured, some are not. Sometimes you lay out for 100 measures. Anyway, I already talked a little bit about chord substitutions, but you know, a lot of times the bass can drone or pedal on one note and it sounds fine. However, don't drone if it starts to clash with the melody, like what I was talking about before. And again, please check the root note of your chord substitution that it doesn't clash inharmoniously or sound awkward against the melody note, regardless of anything else. This is an easy hole to fall into when doing hymn rewrites, because a lot of times these hymns, especially the ones that are done a lot, you know, Christmas hymns and kind of the famous tunes that are done a lot. The reason they're famous is frankly because they're miracles of voice leading. And if you try to mess with those, it's real hard because they have a lot of them have really fast chord movement. Okay. One technical thing I'd like to get into is talking about the frequencies. Neither bass players nor worship leaders sometimes know a lot about this, but it can really, really make a difference. I almost feel like this is my addendum to the seminar that is the little shout out to the sound guy. And one thing that really bothers me as a bass player is when there's weird frequency sound resonance things happening on the stage. Sometimes it can be too boomy, in which case, like, you are playing and either your instrument or the band itself, or the combination of one or two of the instruments, creates a frequency that makes the room resonate or the stage resonate. This can especially be an issue if you have subs underneath the stage. But it's a real tricky thing when it's sounding fine, sounding fine, sounding fine, then you hit a particular note and it's like boom! And nobody knows what to do about it. That's really tricky. The opposite thing can happen as well. It sounds fine, and then all of a sudden you hit a note, and it's like no note happened. This happens to me sometimes where my bass frequency range is real similar to the frequency range of the drums, and I think these sound waves bump into each other in midair and cancel each other out. It's crazy. I think they call that phasing. But the way to monkey with it is to adjust your your EQ, adjust your frequency range that you're putting out. For bass players especially, if you pay special attention to the mid-range knobs on your bass or on your amp, that's kind of the key to finding a good tone that's going to cut through the drums and guitar and make a difference in the sound. Kind of my crash course in bass guitar EQ and mixing tone is this. If it's down there about 50 to 60 hertz, I generalize that sound as being kind of round, full, and deep sounding. Think like dub. That's around 60 hertz. When you get higher into the mid ranges, like 600 hertz, a lot of times people characterize that type of sound as boxy sounding, or it can even be where you can get a little bit of growl in the mid, bringing out that mid-range frequency. Higher into the upper ranges, like 2.5 kilohertz, you'll see, or you'll hear, more presence and articulation. But on the other hand, once you get higher than that, 3K and above, it brings out tends to bring out a lot more string noise, finger sounds, and fret clicking, which is no good. Nobody likes that. But that's kind of just a generalization of the lows, mids, and highs of the bass and how you can monkey with them to even out your frequency palette on stage and make everybody happy and have the sound be nice and full and rich. Next, I'd like to move on to ensemble issues. This is the next big point in our seminar. I know I spoke about orchestration a little bit earlier, but regarding the ensemble, leadership, and just the different instruments and stuff, there's nothing wrong with having the electric bass play along with the string section or double the left hand of the pianist. That oftentimes will make it sound more full. You just don't want them to be like sizzling away in some kind of distracting tone that's like super bright and like zingy. So that may be where you would want to bring down some of those highs in the bass tone. Regarding the piano, though, it is bad for the piano to be playing in the same register as the guitar. So a lot of times it's great for the pianist to kind of like open up their voicings and open up the octave too, so that there's a, instead of just playing in adjacent octaves, open it up one more so you're kind of playing maybe around two octaves above middle C and then an octave and a half or two octaves below middle C. That's kind of the same range as the bass, and it, if they're good ensemble players, they're not going to get too muddy, and it's just going to make it sound like a whole bass section instead of like two bass instruments fighting with each other. One way I grew up doing this is just kind of looking over the shoulder of the piano player and playing what is written in the left hand of the piano. So many lead sheets or rhythm charts, and even, you know, of course, hymns out of the hymn books have a bass part written. Why not just have the bass player play that the same as the piano player is playing that? You don't need to make up anything crazy. And in the same way, my introduction to improvisation was improvising bass lines from the written hymn bass line. I can't think of an example of one that I remember doing that on, but there was tons of them that were really, really fun. Okay. If you don't have a drummer in your band, back to the ensemble issues, if you don't have a drummer, the bass player needs to play a rhythmic pattern like the kick drum would play. Very simple. And not a lot of variation. You can play something simple that changes every single time, and that's no good, because then it's like this weird organic evolving thing. I'd rather play something simple that is simple 8 times in a row. That's what's going to keep everybody together. When I play with my upright bass at church, when there's no drummer, I sometimes will write out my rhythmic pattern with no notes, just the rhythmic pattern, just the way a drummer might write down the kick drum pattern that he's playing with his foot. And if worship leaders kind of like understand how to do this sort of like jotting down a rhythm as the basis to have give the bass player and the drummer, it's such a help. It's such a resource. An example might include, you know, dotted quarter, eighth quarter, rest. Dotted quarter, eighth quarter, rest. Or eighth notes, rest. Eighth notes, rest. Eighth notes, right? Dun dun, dun dun, dun dun, dun dun. One great one I love is the difference between this one. One, two, three, four. Dun dun dun, dun dun dun, and dun dun dun, dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. It's no faster, but it's like the difference between having like a little 16th note there instead of an 8th note. It can be the difference between night and day on having a cool groove and a boring groove. But that brings up my next point about ensemble. I actually forgot to tell this to the bass guitar fundamentals class, but an awesome direction that I think worship leaders can give to bass players and drummers regarding their rhythmic thing is to have something that's like an A and a B phrase, almost like a rhyming couplet or like an A-B rhyme. It really, 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 I think, propels the way the song phrasing goes. And I sung it a second ago, but here's an example. Like, instead of just going, that's cool enough. But if you can do something that's a little bit different the second time, it's really fun for the drummer and the bass player, and I think the congregation picks up on it too, like this. Or I don't know. But you see what I mean about having kind of an A-B to your little rhythmic pattern. Okay. Let's get back to having strings. Sometimes you're going to have a bass player that's an upright player, and he's got the upright and the bow and stuff, and it's this huge thing that he brings in. It's wood and fragile and everything, and oh, sounds always bad amplified. But if you're not amplifying and you have like a string section or something like that, the bass sounds 100 times better if you have a cellist playing with him. Because a lot of times they'll play the same notes, but just an octave apart from each other. It really, really helps make it sound rich. And the bass player makes the cellist feel better because it makes them feel like they're more bassy and more powerful. And the cellist makes the bass player feel better because it makes them sound like that they're a better player. They're more articulate. They're more, they're speaking. Their instrument is speaking better. When really it's just the kind of the blending of the two. The final ensemble issue is this. Bass guitar players can often play the same riffs as guitarists. Duh. They can often even play the same pitches. However, the bass is harder to attack accurately because of the diameter of the strings and the large oscillation of the strings when they're vibrating. You ever seen the big string of the bass go back and forth? It's like this huge oscillation that's like the size of a quarter. That being said, keep in mind when directing your bass players, tell them to grab the string first before letting it go. Think about Robin Hood. He can't just shoot an arrow. He has to pull the string of the bow back first, right? The same way with the bass players. You got to get your finger on the string before it makes a noise, because the noise comes when you let the string go. So that's kind of a directive type thing to give to bass players. This really, really becomes an issue in songs that are kind of slow and real delicate, like where the bass player may be playing like once every, you know, one long note every few measures. If he grabs his finger on there, or she grabs her finger on there, let it go right at the right time. Don't be grabbing it at the right time, because then you're going to be late. Or it's not going to sync up. Okay. I want to finish up with just some hard lessons that I've learned. I've talked a little bit about some of my anecdotes and different crazy adventures I've had. But like I mentioned earlier at the beginning, nothing is worse than not knowing some reference that people make. It makes you feel ignorant, inferior, and it hurts your feelings. That being said, it can be very helpful to use a groove or song as a musical starting point for an arrangement. As long as it's not to be cool, but rather to help lead God's people in the worship. Another kind of lesson that I learned is your stage demeanor. I was discouraged when I've seen photographs of myself on stage, and I have kind of like a frown or a kind of like a determined looking grimace on my face. I think it's better, since it's not just the worship leader leading the worship, the whole band is leading the congregation in worship. It really, I think, makes a difference if you have a sweet smile on your face or if you're really, really worshiping. I heard this amazing lecture one time where the speaker said, worshiping God is like going on a date with my wife. if I do it just to because I'm supposed to and not because I want to, that's no good. That doesn't serve and love her. Mm-hmm. We're commanded to worship God and praise Him, but if we do it with the wrong heart attitude, that's no good. That's no good. He wants us to love praising Him, I think that the attitude of our my prayer every time I worship or help lead in the music ministry is that I'll have the right kind of attitude in my heart and the right kind of direction in my countenance. Okay. Likewise, don't close your eyes and get too into the music. This is something that I think would be great for worship leaders to direct their bass players about, because of all the people that should be getting really like into the music and closing their eyes and doing their head back and forth, the bass player is not the one that should be doing that. The bass players are there to keep the band together when everyone else, including the leader, forgets the chart and arrangement. I found myself screaming my head off and, like one hand in the air, charging into a repeat of the chorus when it clearly states on my chart that we're actually going into the soft a cappella bridge section. I didn't see it because I had my eyes closed and I was getting a little bit too into it. Thank you so much for listening to my seminar on what every bass player wishes the worship leader knew. Just as a quick conclusion and a wrap up of my points, I believe that it's true to tell bass players that less is more and to play more simply is better, but do it in a way that gives them confidence. Tell them that they're the trunk of the tree that is keeping the ensemble together, and it'll make them step up and quit playing this crazy, super busy stuff. So in conclusion, I think that every bass player wishes that the worship leader would utilize their good people skills, have a little bit of theoretical and musical understanding, especially in as it applies to the bass and bass guitar. Bass players, I think, really appreciate it when worship leaders show an understanding sensitivity to technological and technical things, especially as they relate to the drums and bass player. A lot of worship leaders have a background in choir, or conservatory training, and this anything that has a cord or a speaker or electricity freaks them out, and they just don't talk about it. Worship leaders, don't be afraid to get your feet wet. It sounds complicated, but this business of electricity and understanding the amps and the speakers is not that complicated. it sounds like it is, but it's not that complicated. Even a basic, you know, a basic internet search about electricity and current can kind of open your eyes to the stuff that kind of sounds like weird, a foreign language. Okay. My fourth point is talking about some ensemble issues where there's ways that the bass, the worship leader can either use the bass or tell the bass player to not play. And when they hear how awesome it is, when they come back in, they won't feel inferior when they had to lay out. It raises the whole level of the ensemble, I think, to have some orchestration of instruments coming in and out. Thank you so much, and I pray that this will be helpful in your churches and in your ministries. Thanks.